Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, the jobs report. Of course, we will take it apart and then put it back together for you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 7th of November today, Friday. Great, as always, to have you with us. By way of review, since the headline number did come out at 8:30 this morning, Washington time, the economy added 214,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate ticked down to 5.8%. It was almost uniformly a good report. Almost uniformly. The fly in the ointment was the same fly that's been in the labor market ointment for years now. Wages that are just stuck. Average hourly pay in this country rose 3 cents last month. Not 3%, but 3 cents. So, what do you do with that? What if there are a way to flip things around a little bit, get more wage growth, even if somehow it meant less job growth? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going today.
Over the past few years, everyone, and I mean everyone, has talked about
job growth,
job growth,
job growth,
job growth,
job growth.
And that makes perfectly good sense. Economists say after a recession, there's a sort of natural order to a recovery. Wharton economist Kent Smetter says, think of the recession like a monster fire that burns down the forest. Then
you get a lot of job growth. That's the trees growing up. But as they get taller, you know, they're competing for sunlight. And that's kind of the wage growth.
Smetter says in this most recent jobs report, wages went up 0.1%, barely keeping up with inflation. But the economist says some trees, or in this case industries, are getting big enough to see some competition.
Trucking and manufacturing, as well as in some of the professional services like lawyers and accountants, you are seeing higher wage growth, maybe 0.2%, 0.3%.
Here's the thing. If the ranks of the unemployed keep thinning, Brookings Institution economist Gary Burtless says wages will come around. And if that happens,
then profits would not rise as fast in the future as they have so far in this economic recovery.
And remember, Burtless says business profits have hit record highs almost every quarter. Maybe, he says, it's time for a bigger share to go to the workers.
And if they did have more spending power, that could boost consumption and boost the reasons for employers to add to their payrolls because they can sell more stuff more easily.
Burtless says while plenty of folks in Washington keep banging the job growth drum, voters sent a clear message this week supporting minimum wage hikes. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Today's unemployment report was, of course, just the kicker to quite a week in the American economy. Here to dissect and discuss are Neela Richardson from Redfin and John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai. So, John, let's pick up where Dan left off. Rising wages are what, a bad thing? They cause inflation? Is that what, I mean, what's the negative here?
There isn't really a negative at this stage. We could have a lot more rising wages before we would have to start worrying about inflation. There's no signs of inflationary pressure in the economy.
Right.
If anything, we've actually been having signs that inflation isn't as strong as the Fed wants it to be.
Right.
So nobody should worry at all about inflation. Anybody who says we have inflation is out of their minds.
And you heard it here first. Neela, quickly, a gut check on the jobs report, and then we'll move on. Uniformly good, right? Minus the wages thing?
You know, uniformly, the trend is good. I'm glad to see 220,000 jobs on average over the last 12 months.
Right,
I just
right.
wish it was a little more substantive in terms of labor market participation, wage growth, and, you know, just all around people getting good jobs that were higher paying.
All right. John, to your point about inflation, does this change Janet Yellen's timing on interest rate hikes next year at all, do you think?
I do not think it does anything to the Fed's program at all. It certainly doesn't push it forward. It probably doesn't push it back. They're going to do what they're going to do. And people are going to keep watching these new economic numbers to try to predict whether it changes it. But I think these little slight changes are probably – there's too much attention paid to them. The Fed is not going to be moved unless there's a big change in direction.
Well, but wait. I mean, Neela, Janet Yellen has said repeatedly, we will look at the data, right?
That's right. But the data is not telling us the same stuff it used to tell us before, that 5.8%. It does mask a lot of underemployment. Huh. It lacks a very stubborn long-term unemployed rate, and it masks some things that may be structural. So when they talk about data, it's not just the top-line numbers. It's all the way down deep into that tunnel.
All right. Let's go to the election. Obviously, Tuesday, big night for the GOP. John, to which theory do you subscribe, that nothing will get done now in an era of divided government, or that now that the GOP in the Senate has a stake in what happens and they are a little bit on the line, something will happen?
I'm going to go with option C, which is nothing will get done
that,
again.
Yeah, still,
you
right,
know,
yeah.
So it's not that now nothing will get done. We've had a divided government. There's very little signs that anything is going to change. People have talked about, you know, all of the issues that fall into my bailiwick, you know, banking reform, housing, you know, the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie reform. None of that's getting done. Immigration isn't getting done. You know, we just saw these guys announce basically that they're, you know, hey, I'm going to do something on my own. Oh, no, you're not, because now we're going to do, you know, we're going to fight you. Nothing's happening.
They had a nice lunch today at the White House. They all did, Neela. But which theory do you subscribe to?
I'm going to go with option D. It depends. You know, last
you guys
year,
can't do that. There was A and a B. There was no C and D, man.
Last year, the most interesting dynamic to me coming out of the Republican Party was the Republican versus Republican battle. There is still, even though we no longer have a divided partisan House and Senate, we still have a very divided Republican Party, which is across the spectrum in terms of conservatism. If Republicans get on the same page, there may be areas of agreement when it comes to trade, when it comes to this popular minimum wage hike, and when it comes to some other issues like immigration that both parties wanted to see happen for quite a while now.
All right. Well, we got 2 years to figure it out. John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Redfin. Thanks, you guys.
Have a good weekend.
Kai.
All right, you too. A couple of more things before we proceed with the rest of the broadcast today. Item number one, put a little reminder in your calendars for mid-March, would you? Today, the Supreme Court agreed to get back into the health care debate. Expect oral arguments, as I said, mid-March-ish, on this question, whether the federal government could give insurance subsidies to people who live in states where the feds, where Washington, set up the health care exchanges, as opposed to where states set them up. It sounds highly technical. It is, but it is going to be a very, very big deal. Item number two, the city of Detroit. This afternoon, a judge approved the city's plan to get out of bankruptcy protection, Chapter 9, if you're keeping track. This was, as you know, the biggest municipal filing ever. It finished in 16 months, which may seem like a long time, but is actually incredibly fast. Retiree pensions are going to be cut by 4.5%. The city is going to wipe $7 billion in debt off its books and spend $1.7 billion to demolish buildings, buy new fire trucks and ambulances, and upgrade basic services. On Wall Street today, it was fine. No big deal. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another 1,500 American soldiers are going to Iraq. The White House says they will be in non-combat roles, advising and assisting Iraqi and Kurdish troops in the fight against ISIS. That fight has seen oil production disrupted. It has seen supply routes compromised and bombings that have hurt businesses and business confidence all over that country. The BBC's Andrew Hoskin reports now from Baghdad on what all of that feels like.
Remarkable scenes here at the Lusia Hotel in central Baghdad. Dozens of people are thought to have died here when a suicide bomber detonated his truck just outside the building, bringing down the whole front of the hotel. Now, just a few hours later, one gang is clearing away all the debris, while another gang is filling in the hole left in the road by the truck bomb itself.
More than 30 people were thought to have died in the blast here in Wathik Square. Dozens more injured, two hotels and a restaurant put out of business. Overseeing the clear-up was Shahab Ahmed, owner of the devastated Aliouza Hotel.
But of course, all of this is affecting all our businesses. And of course, this is what Islamic State and the other terrorist organizations are trying to do in Iraq, to scare off all the foreign visitors and destroy our businesses.
Iraq.
The insurgency has damaged every aspect of an economy that's been blighted by corruption and battered by conflict for years. Even Baghdad taxi drivers like Abir Abbas find it difficult to earn a living these days, or even move around.
The price of petrol is also hitting us hard. Right now it's very expensive, and also we waste a lot of fuel just sitting in the congestion caused by the checkpoints and the rest.
The resilience of the people of Baghdad and the businessmen here is really quite astonishing. Just 3 days ago, this little corner shop was devastated when a bomb went off just across the road. All the glass was blown out, all the produce inside the shop was destroyed, and yet just a few days later, you'd never know that anything had happened. All the shelves are stocked, the shoppers are coming in to buy what they need, and this place is back in business. The store owner, Ali Sajid Shaker, was already struggling with the rising costs of commodities caused by the IS occupation of much of northern Iraq, which has cut supply routes and put up transport costs. Now the bombings deter his customers.
After the explosion happened here, no one was around. They all stayed at home. When there are more bombings, people tend to avoid the shops and the markets.
It's an ill wind that doesn't blow someone somewhere some good, and nowhere is that old adage more true, perhaps, than here in Al-Sadoun Street in central Baghdad, where there are literally dozens of shops selling wheelchairs and a variety of disability aids. Many are reporting a roaring trade, and it's not hard to understand why. Hussein Talib Sahib was a manager of one of the wheelchair shops.
Recently, we've been selling a lot of wheelchairs because, as you know, there are a lot of car bombs and suicide bombing in Baghdad, so there is a lot of injured people. We mainly import our wheelchairs from China, and before it was easy to get them. But now our import costs have increased fivefold because Islamic State controls much of the north of here. So we have to transport the chairs from the south by sea at Basra.
A key part of the government's strategy in dealing with the militants is to try and undermine the economy of IS. Few countries have faced an insurgency as ruthless or as well-resourced as Islamic State. Oil and money will be critical factors in the final outcome. To survive, Iraq is going to need plenty of both, and sadly, a greater expenditure of blood.
The BBC's Andrew Hoskin in Baghdad. There was an obituary in the Los Angeles Times this week for a businessman who took a small Southern California grocery chain and turned it into a national brand. John Shields was his name. Trader Joe's is the company. Shields ran Trader Joe's for more than a decade, 1988 to 2001, and in the process, he transformed his slice of the grocery store experience. Here's Nova Sappho.
I'll start this story with a confession. I'm biased. When I moved from Los Angeles to Chicago, I made sure my new apartment was within walking distance of a Trader Joe's.
They almost have a cult-like following.
David Livingston of DJL Research says as Trader Joe's has grown, it's charted a unique path.
They don't try to compete with the big chains. They grow very slow and methodically because they're very conservative financially and they're extremely cautious.
Those are values John Shields instilled in the company. But when he took over from Trader Joe's founder Joe Coulombe in 1988, he did reinvigorate the chain by investing heavily in its unique brand. John Springer is retail editor at the trade publication Supermarket News.
Much of what they sell is their own label stuff. You can't buy Trader Joe's brand tortilla chips in any store.
John Shields expanded from a couple dozen California locations to 174 branches across the country. In the last decade, the expansion has continued. There are now some 400 Trader Joe's stores.
Today, they're the kind of company that communities that don't have Trader Joe's have Facebook pages, you know, urging them to come. And there's a lot of excitement when they do come to a city.
After all, how many grocery chains do you know with their own fan-written song?
It's the apple juice that's addictive as crack. It's cilantro pizza. It's organic.
That song, by the way, has almost a million views on YouTube. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up, did you ever wonder where the music business as we know it came from?
It's 1920, and you've been involved with blues or early jazz or gospel music in your church. Nobody was interested.
We'll tell you about the guy who changed that, but first, let's do the numbers. Kind of a mixed end to things on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 19 points today, a 10%, closed at 17,573. The NASDAQ gave back 5 points. That's a 10%, 4,632 there. The S&P 500 up a smidge. Let's call it unchanged just because it's easier that way, honestly. Close to 2,031. For the week, the Dow up 1.1%. The NASDAQ up, really, I mean this now, just a hair, 0.04%, for those of you who really, really want to know. The S&P 500 up 0.7%. Shares in Sears shot up 31%. You try saying that. After the retailer said it was thinking about starting a real estate investment trust to raise money, the retailer, by the by, has had 9 straight quarters of losses and has been closing stores, so it's got a lot of real estate to deal with. Bonds up, the yield on the 10-year T-note, down to 2.30%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Sotheby's releases quarterly earnings. Makers and innovators who want to design ornaments for the White House are on deadline for the first ever White House 3D printed ornament challenge. You have until Monday to submit your entry. And 45 years ago, the TV show Sesame Street premiered. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Right behind supply and demand in the economic pedagogy comes costs and benefits. It's not all that much of a stretch to say that those costs and benefits influence our actions pretty heavily. So here's an example, just for argument's sake. We'll go with the benefits first. Gas prices are down, as you know. The average in South Carolina, by the way, is $2.68 a gallon, a very serious benefit from the supply and demand equation, right? The cost, one of them, anyway, of that, is the long-term impact of burning that gallon of gas on the environment. Short-term benefit, long-term cost, which we love and which surprises economists and social scientists not one teeny little bit. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
There are countless examples of us failing to plan long-term. Smoking, grabbing that third donut, burning fossil fuels. The cost or benefit is just too far away, says behavioral economist Dan Ariely of Duke.
Imagine that somebody offered you some investment and they say, you know, here's an investment you can pay now and you can win 1,000 times more, but in 200 years. Would you invest in that? And people are just not designed to do this.
We do react when our emotions are stirred. Say enemy Martians were warming the Earth, that, Ariely says, would get us going. It's not that the scientists aren't loud about climate change. The new report warns of irreversible impacts and 95% confidence humans are the main cause. We just don't listen to them, says risk perception consultant David Ropeek.
So if you're green, you'll trust Bill McKibben, and if you're brown, you'll trust George Will, Pickett, right? It doesn't matter what the facts are. It matters whether you trust who's giving them to you, because you want to be true to the tribe.
In fact, some say there's too much science out there by now. Northeastern University communication scholar Matthew Nisbet.
We're well past the point where, you know, messaging the science or trying to communicate about the science more effectively is going to change anyone's opinions. If anything, that's going to move people to the polls.
Not voting polls. In fact, climate was hardly an issue this election. The key to many is bringing the issue closer to people. One bank website actually takes your photo and it ages you to make your future real. Either that or events will focus your mind, says UCLA economist Matthew Kahn.
In the summer 2010, there was a horrible heat wave in Moscow, and it killed thousands. Nobody in Moscow had an air conditioner. In the aftermath of that event, thousands of people have purchased air conditioners there. The people have adapted and changed their lifestyle to be ready for the next shock.
Self-interest. There's a climate change motivator. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The early history of the music industry in this country is filled with enterprising A&R men. Artists and repertoire is what that stands for. A&R men who'd scope out new talent all over the country, sign them to a contract, and maybe make a little money. A guy named Ralph Peer, whose career started with wax recording cylinders and ended with vinyl LPs decades later, was one of those guys. He was one of the major forces behind popularizing what was then known as roots music, country and gospel and blues, all those American genres that in the early part of the 20th century weren't really a part of popular music as we know it, or knew it, I guess. Barry Mazur's new book about Ralph Peer is called Ralph Peer and the Making of Popular Roots Music. Barry, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So if, not to cast aspersions here, but if Ralph Peer is as important as you say he is in this 300-page book, how come we've never heard of him?
That's a good one. So his family actually approached me and made available 50 years of his papers and letters and royalty statements. And nobody had this stuff before. And so he shows up in everybody else's biography, in country music and blues and jazz and gospel, but at second hand. I got the chance to tell the story.
And here it is. You say he is almost single-handedly, I think is your message, responsible for the rise of popular roots music in this country and then almost everything that comes from it, which is basically the music industry as we know it today.
Yeah, that's a broad way to put it, but I think you can make a case,
grand,
and I try to. But what we think of as roots music today, all of those genres I just mentioned, were not true parts of popular music. Nobody was making use of them. Nobody was commercializing them. No one was bringing them to the people. By the time he was done, first as a record-producing A&R man, then as a global publisher, that kind of music was popularized, and it was brought all over the world.
Give me a snapshot of the music industry at the beginning of his career, which is the early days of the last century, right? I mean, it's all sheet music. There's no real commercial recordings, all of that.
It was oriented towards Broadway, towards band music, towards genteel parlor music. And it's 1920, and you've been involved with blues or early jazz or gospel music in your church or what was called the first hillbilly music, yeah. Eventually country. Nobody was interested, and certainly nobody read sheet music. Nobody read music at all. So that didn't become a major part of the music industry, and they didn't even record it.
Well, you mentioned 1920 and recorded music. I want to play something for you now. It's Mamie Smith. It's her jazz band, and it's a song called Crazy Blues. Here we go. Let's play a little bit of that. Peer records and produces that record, and in 1920, it sells 1 million copies, which is staggering.
That was the first recording of blues sung by an African-American ever, that record. It hadn't been done.
And he also, we should say, just because this is a business program, figures out new ways to derive payments from all this, the royalty system. Tell us more about that.
It was very central, and they're almost one story. Obviously, most people don't hear the business part of it, but he saw something early on by emphasizing personalities. The reason he would bring Jimmy Rogers or the Carter family is that they were strong personalities with songs, and the personality sold that song, and then the song would sell again. So Jimmy Rogers wound up with a mansion and with Cadillacs, not just because of his own records. 20 people were recording those songs.
Let's play, as long as you brought him up, a little bit of Jimmy Rogers and Louis Armstrong here. It's called Blue Yodel Number 9.
He says, big boy, you'll have to tell me your name. The yodely, yodely.
I don't know what it is that makes that yodel blue, but all right, we'll just go with that one. You know, it's funny. I made fun of you at the beginning of this interview for drawing grand conclusions about, you know, his effect on the music industry as we know it today. But you flip to the back cover of this book, and the blurbs you've got are from Bob Dylan, Ry Cooter, Chuck D the Rapper, Donovan, and Laura Cantrell. I mean, it's kind of an eclectic smattering of people who know about this guy and appreciate his impact on their business.
Their business wouldn't be there if he hadn't been there first.
Mm-hmm. What do you? Totally random question. What do you think he would make of iTunes and the way we get our music now?
He would have found the way to deal with it. This is not the first time we had a question of how do we get people paid? How do we get singers paid and performers? How do we get songwriters paid? This medium we're on was considered at first this terrible threat to the record business because you bought a radio, you heard music, you never had to buy a record again. Well, that's not the way things went. Yeah. It got to be a great medium for extending records. So I think he would look at it the same way. He'd say, you know, what can we make of this? He wouldn't have been shocked by it.
The book by Barry Mazur is called Ralph Peer and the Making of Popular Roots Music. Barry, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which it does occur to me, I shall confess, I probably should have taken special care to mention before on the program, but, you know, 2020 hindsight and all that. So there was this jobs report today, right? 214,000 new jobs last month. The rate dropped to 5.8%, except that maybe that's not right. There is, it turns out, and as statisticians among you already know, a margin of error on that sucker. The jobs report is accurate, the Bureau of Labor Statistics tells us, to within 90,000 jobs, plus or minus, and 0.2 percentage points, again, plus or minus, on the rate. So, who knows? Maybe it's 124,000 new jobs and a 6% unemployment rate. Probably not, but we don't know. All right, it's Friday. We got to go. The Dow up 19 points today, 10%, 17,573. NASDAQ gave back 5 points, 10%, 4,632. The S&P 500 up a touch, 2,031. We'll call that unchanged. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Orr. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a very good week. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.